Being trained in an effective crisis management system is imperative for minimizing behavioral issues and the need for restraint in schools and treatment facilities. But not all crisis management systems were created equal. If we are going to meet the growing intense behavioral needs of individuals while simultaneously reducing the need for restraints, every leader and policymaker who is involved in areas related to behavioral challenges should understand what a complete crisis management system is comprised of and how to embed one into any setting. For more information, check out crisisintervention.com. Welcome to the Crisis in Education podcast, where behavior science meets education. I'm your host, Dr. Pauly, exploring avenues for change and growth alongside my guests. Join us as we work towards turning crises into opportunities. Okay, welcome back to the Crisis in Education podcast. I am your host, Dr. Pauly, and I am here with Nat Green. Welcome to the podcast. Nat, how you doing, brother?
Great. I'm excited to be here. Looking forward to having a fun discussion with you.
Yeah, well, Nat and I were actually already chatting offline, and I'm like, man, I kind of like what you have to say and, you know, how you have to say it. We were kind of keeping it real. And what attracted me to Nat was that he actually focused on improving college careers, right? Make college better for individuals. But when I read up some of his bio on things like, you know, improving critical thinking, grit, problem solving, EQ, this stuff really resonates with me. And, you know, I know Nat wants to get to the root cause of or talk about why kids in college are failing and what they need to do to be successful. And for me, I meandered and I spent 11 years getting through my master's degree because I was working on the beach. I was lifeguarding, man. I was having a good old time, but I didn't know what the hell I wanted to do. And how many people get to that degree and they're like, what do I do now? It's probably not the direction they want to go. I don't know, man. I think we can do a lot better with what's going on at the university. But anyways, brother, welcome, man.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So first of all, if you can, give us a little bit about your background and what led you to where you are right now.
Okay. So, you know, you're saying before I sound a bit funny, and that's because I grew up in China.
I didn't say funny.
Different. I speak differently from others.
So, I said you had an accent.
Accent, that's it. So I have an accent and I grew up in Hong Kong in China. My father was a university professor there. His technical title was senior lecturer, but the American system, he'd be a professor. My mother was an English teacher. So education's always been very important to me and to my family. And I grew up in a community that was, you know, a lot of educators. And then along the way, I went to university and things, and I ended up working in consulting. And then I ended up co-founding a consulting business that I went on to run. And we hired...
Oh, consulting and education?
No, industrial consulting. So like helping, yeah, it's a great question. So helping large industrial businesses solve problems that they have so they can run more effectively, more efficiently, use their resources, more effectively and so on.
No, this is the world I'm in, man. Interesting. But yeah, like industrial organizational psychology.
Yeah, exactly. And we were solving essentially very hard technical problems that existed. And then also, you know, every problem is a human problem, right? Behind any issue stands a person making a decision. And so there was a lot of how do you understand what's going on with the people involved and how do you help them understand they can do and achieve a lot more than they think is possible. So I did that. And then I retired from that a few years ago. And I've now started an educational company because that's sort of what I'm passionate about. And my business partner in that and I have worked together for more than 10 years. We've written a couple of books together, and we've just been waiting till the time was right for both of us to go do this. And it was either going to be politics, something in politics, or education. And education just seems so much better a place to go.
But you know what? The only thing with that is that, man, we need some people who have high values that understand education in some political positions because, I mean, politicians are making bad policies, and that, man, has a really bad impact on the world, man. There's some bad stuff out there.
Yeah, I would say that it's best not to spend too much time on politics. It's just too painful.
Yeah, but I agree, Doug. I don't want anything to do with me. I just want to make a difference. Yeah. What books did you write, by the way?
Me and Eric Fogg wrote an amateur political book. And then based on that, we were picked up by a publishing house. And I published a book called Stop Guessing. I actually have a copy here. It's the Stop Guessing the Nine Behaviors, right, of great
Oh,
problem solvers.
I
So
love it. It's
that was
behavioral,
fun.
brother.
Yeah, exactly. And then because I think that's the important bit of problem solving is the attitude you take to it, and it's how you build the skills and the belief that you can actually solve the problem. Because once you know you can solve a problem, it's just work after that. But before you know you can solve it, it could be an impossible task that you think can never be achieved. And then a couple of other technical books that are really quite technical that I won't even share with you.
Yeah, it's all right, man. This book is pretty well reviewed here. Got and you got quite a bit of good ratings on it. Very cool, man. I'll look into this stuff. I bet that that we're talking a lot of the same language or the same principles, though our language might be different on it. So very interesting. The nine behaviors of great problem solvers. Nat Green. Cool, man. Cool. We're doing some of the same work here. I specialize in leadership as well. I got a few books out myself on it. All right, cool. All right, so you'll continue. I didn't mean to interrupt you, man. I got right in the middle of this stuff, wanting to know about the books, but it was giving me kind of a focus on where you specialize.
No, I appreciate that. And it's actually important background because although I come from a community of educators, I am not an educator myself in the traditional sense, right?
Formal,
I've been involved in
formally.
all aspects of college except for actually teaching in the classroom or administering it. But I attended, I have kids there, I've been a consumer, and so on. And then I've also sat on the development board of my old college in the UK. So I've seen it sort of from the side and inside what's going on.
Okay.
Fascinating seeing my kids go through, some of my older kids go through college at the moment and the impact that's having. But then what Eric and I have done is to Futures Forge, which is our new business, we've brought sort of an engineer and consulting and business focus into the problem and of how to educate kids better. And I'll tie this back into sort of K through 12 in a minute. But when we started, we thought, look, what are people complaining about college? Well, the quality of the people coming out, right? The people who are hiring. And then the people who are there are complaining about the cost, the time, other issues. There's a lot of, controversy going on at colleges that I'll, there's enough information on that out there. I don't need to tap into that. But we started by thinking, well, how can we just make it more efficient, right? Like an engineer. And we looked at like, what classes can you cut? Like, or things like why do people spend 4 years at college when they're really only working part-time for half the year? What if you took a different approach and had them work like they'd started in a job and they worked 48 weeks a year or something, or 50 weeks of the year? We were looking at it that way and we realized it was just the wrong way to look at it. You can make some incremental gains, but it's not interesting enough. And so then we went back to the science. And we really wanted to ask two questions. What is it that academics have studied that they think make the difference in performance, right? In how people perform when they leave college? So, i.e., they're there to learn. We're trying to make them better or have them have a better, more successful life, however you define that, right? What are the attributes that people need to build to go do that? And so we've found whole bunch of research, but we love this meta study by a guy called Schmidt that summarizes the attributes. And so we have six attributes that we're focused on. And the other lens that we took is, well, most people aren't going to go start their own business right out of college or out of high school. Okay, so they're going to need to get a job. So, it's to start their career. So we were thinking, well, what do employers say that they hire based on and that they promote based on? Right. And so there's a whole bunch of studies on that. We gathered those, summarized them, and we've identified six skills that people need to develop to succeed. And so we've sort of built from the ground up on that. And one of the things we've learned is pretty much nobody is approaching education this way. Like education is structured at all levels based on what was done 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and it's iterated and tweaked from there. And it's such a powerful monolith. It's so hard to envisage a clean sheet adjustment, right, to how we do things. And so that's what we've done. We've just thrown the whole thing out and gone, how would I want to be developed? If I was 18 again now, looking forward, how would I want to be developed? And then all those same skills and attributes and approach, learning approach that we focus on can be applied earlier. It's just that's not where we're focusing because there's not a lot of discretionary spend at the point of consumption before 18 in the United States. So yes, there's people going to private schools and they're all well established and but there's not a lot of flexibility there. And so a college is when most people take on vast amounts of debt and financial obligations. So we want to try and make a better system there.
Interesting, man. Are you going to be unpacking any of those skills or here today? Because you've piqued my curiosity, that's for sure.
Let's take a quick break.
If you work across schools or treatment facilities and you want an environment characterized by students or clients behaving well and meeting their goals, you need Everyday Behavior Tools. These tools are so powerful and generalizable that you can train anybody, anywhere in them. And here is the best part. The entire instructor training is online. If you are interested in becoming an Everyday Behavior Tools trainer to improve behavior in your organization while also generating more income for yourself, go to crisisintervention.com.
Yeah, I mean, some of this is quite controversial and some of it's very straightforward.
Let's get controversial, brother.
Okay. Well, the inconvenient truth is that all academic research that we have seen says that at least 2/3 of your future predicted performance can be understood by what your general mental ability score is when you're 18. So, i.e., that's an academic proxy for IQ, you know, and the standard proxy measure for that is your SAT score. Now, that doesn't mean it's deterministic. It just means probably, you know, from a probability standpoint, you can figure it out.
There's a correlation there.
And it's very, very strong. So, and in a complex job, it's actually 75%. Because you can imagine if you're going to, run the State Department, it probably helps if you're smarter than the average person to be able to get that job and perform well at it because it's a very complex thing to do. So, but what we're focused on is, given that, right, when that's why we don't spend a lot of time arguing about that because the science is very clear. But what we're interested in is, what are the things you can do? What makes the difference in the other 35%? Right? What are the attributes and stuff that you can go work at? And so we've got it all up on our website and all the science, all the references to all the papers. You know, you can go do as much research as you want to. And given this is a podcast for educators, I encourage them to go take a look, right?
But we'll drop this in the show notes when we're done so you guys can have the link.
Brilliant. Yeah, brilliant. And so once you know someone's GMA, the next most important thing is, believe it or not, personal integrity. And there's not a lot of work directly working on improving people's personal integrity. And yet that is a mutable trait. So your IQ once you're 18 is well, you can make it go down, I guess, if you box too much, you know, get hit in the head too much. there isn't an understood way to improve it, right?
We have genetic predisposition. We're all born with a cup. You know what I mean? How much we fill that cup up. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, that's no doubt there's part of it. But also, it's a nature-nurture thing, right? So there's definitely a nature part to it, but there's also a nurture part to
it.
Well,
that's the other part. I think that's where the personal integrity piece comes in. I believe that's shaped up through our histories. You're not born with integrity or not. It's your experience, right? And your experience of reinforcement that says, that determines whether you are going to have integrity. And I think integrity from a behavior analytic point of view, we might boil it down to say-do correlation. I say something, I do it, whether I say it to myself and I do it, right? And also how closely we're living to, how closely those do's are aligned with our stated values, a way of being and doing, which a lot of people don't know their own values. So when we talk about integrity, I don't know that without understanding your values, you might have good say-do correlation, but those behaviors might not be aligned with your values because you're not very aware of your values. So in order to have integrity, you need to know what those values actually are. Have you had experience with that?
I agree with that. I think if you don't know what you're trying to do and what you value, it's very hard to stay true to it, right? But interestingly enough, one of the other important traits is adaptability. So you also have to see new situations and learn to adapt. And that might be the ability to let go of something you thought was true and isn't, or you thought was important to you. And in another phase of life, it isn't. And so I think several of these are important. But I think the really critical thing is education isn't organized to improve these things.
Man, do I agree so much, man? Because the two things we talk about, personal integrity, we're so focused on academics and K-12, right? Well, we can reinforce this type of, teach people how to have integrity, right? It's an important character trait. And we can also teach adaptability. When we talk about grit, right? We're talking about really, without adaptability, we die as a human species. Not only the strong survive, right? It's about adapting. And adapting means being able to assess, problem solve, make decisions, take effective action. interaction, even under conditions that are stressful. You know, you have to be able to do that stuff. And a lot of people don't because they're not directly, specifically, directly taught how to do this stuff. And they end up falling back on their old habits, you know, and doing things that might be well-meaning. They solve an immediate problem for them, but it's winning the battle but losing the war because they're not behaving in alignment with their values, right? It's why people do drugs and why they drink and, you know, why you eat the food because it tastes good immediately, and, you know, but it's not in service of your health, et cetera, et cetera. I know I'm preaching the choir, brother, but I'm just laying it out for some of my audience.
No, and I agree with that. And the thing, again, that's fascinating about this is from an educational standpoint is, you know, 100 years ago, you had to go to school, you know, to college or to high school or whatever to learn because that's where the books were. And that's where you could access somebody who could guide you in learning, because it turns out it's really difficult for most of us to sit down and just read a bunch of books on our own and learn. I mean, like, apparently Einstein did that and other people, right? But so few people are really good at that, that we sort of know their names. And so for the rest of us mere mortals, we need people to help guide us along the way or assist them. But the challenge is, if you used to have to go to high school to learn before, you had to go to college to access research papers or whatever, every piece of knowledge in the world is available on your cell phone right now. So the world's totally changed. And so the idea that you would go to high school to learn algebra, I mean, it's almost ridiculous, right? Like especially if you look forward five years, and we're going to have AI-assisted tutors, right, who should know more about you than any human being can. And let's not worry about the sort of 1984 thing of some AI tutor indoctrinating our kids from the age of five, right? If we assume we have some safeguards and they're well-meaning, then they'll understand things like, oh, maybe I've got a bit of ADD. Maybe, you know, I like to learn in certain ways. And they can craft my learning experience and I can learn everything I want that way. So then you go, well, if that's the case, what's the point of college? Because it's certainly not information transfer. And what's the point of high school? Because it's certainly not access to knowledge, because that's all gone now. And I think that when you look at how these organizations are organized, you realize that there's sort of no hope of easily transitioning to the new way. Because if you imagine, like, if I have, like, my fingers represent vertical knowledge base, right? So, like, mathematics, French, you know, whatever, physics, you know, pottery, you know, ceramics. If those represent that, then the skills that you need and the attributes you need to develop actually organize the other way. Like, so critical thinking, you need to become good at critical thinking. Well, you can learn that by planning a project in ceramics, right? But where's the critical thinking department that is organized around advancing that skill specifically? And that's what's missing, you know, from my perspective. And until we change that, I think teachers are going to continue to have a very hard time, and colleges are going to have a very difficult time justifying their great expense. Because, you know, the knowledge is free. You know, the cost of your tuition at college should be about $500. That's probably what it's worth at the moment.
Well, I think that I hear you, man. I agree with part of this. And maybe we agree on this all together, right? I think that, yes, the knowledge is all accessible. I think what we should be focusing on, I agree with this as well. Like, I think we do need to directly teach people to critically think. I think that should be a core skill that we're measuring. We're measuring, like, you know, if it was Bloom's taxonomy, the people's ability to recall things, right? Mm-hmm. I can't have my fighter be able to recall how to throw a jab. They need to be able to automatically, effectively, efficiently throw the jab and move their head, you know, in the actual fight. So I have to give them knowledge, and then I need to support the transference of learned knowledge, right? The generalization of learned knowledge into the national environment. And I believe that's what these learning environments should be doing. And they're not, because theory doesn't generalize to the real world. You know, you might have some knowledge about it, you might be able to talk about it, but can you actually apply it? And I see this so very clearly. I've had thousands of hours in my laboratory, right, which is the gym, and I've seen people be able to throw flawless combinations outside of the cage or the ring. You put them in the fight, they take a beating. So coming back to learning environment, I believe these learning environments should foster a love for learning, right? That's number one, right? Foster a love for learning. And so they need to structure the environment in a way that enhances that fosters that, finds out what their reinforcers are, their preferences are, right? But then supports the generalization, which means simulations, right? Which is, you just talked about project learning, right? We need them to be able to take these knowledge and skills and do things with them. And I don't feel like the way that the structure is set up is that way, right? But we could. to your point, right? With technology, we have AI, we have virtual reality, and imagine like learning about, history through VR and learning, in college, teaching a teacher has to teach a class, and so they it can safely make mistakes the way my fighters safely make mistakes during sparring because that's our simulation and we give that they get feedback on it. They can make adjustments to their behavior so they can produce different results in the future. And it's the repetition of that that allows for scalability across all these areas. But without that, you're right, the rote knowledge is there, but it's designing the learning experience, I think, that these institutions should be responsible for. But all they're concerned about is the grade. And that makes no sense to me. It drives me friggin' nuts.
Yeah, look, you touch on many important points there. And the thought that's foremost in my mind is some advice my father gave to me years and years and years ago. And he grew up in northern New Jersey and he went to college. And then he was fortunate enough to go do a PhD in the United Kingdom. That's how he met my mother, and I ended up in Hong Kong, right? But what he said is, look, you understand that when I was at college, we used a slide rule and a book of tables. Okay, it's totally. And then his PhD, he goes, 20 years after his PhD, you could simulate it on a computer. His entire 4 years of work, you could simulate it on a computer in about a day. Okay, so he goes, the actual knowledge I gained in terms of direct knowledge was worthless, okay, from the longer perspective. But it's the ability to learn that's important. And of course, my wife and I came across a similar thing when we were looking at one of our kids' AP biology textbooks. And she looked at it and she goes, we didn't even know half the material in this when I was at high school. We didn't know it yet. Like, we pushed back the frontier of what we know. And so what you realize is, it's this, the age-old thing of it's learning how to learn that's important. So, and then when you tie it into your point on motivation, right? Personal motivation, kids being motivated. If you're motivated, you retain way, way more knowledge. Okay, you learn way quicker. I don't really like GPA as a metric. I think there's a lot of flaws with it, but you score, a motivated kid scores like a half a point of GPA higher. Okay, just if you measure how motivated they are, you measure the ones who aren't, you see how they do in this class. So it's not to do with their intrinsic capability, it's to do with their focus and motivation, right? That aspect. So how do you blend it all together? So here's an example of what we're doing in our 1 year program, right? Our 1 year post-college program is we have a module called How to Become an Expert in Anything in 4 weeks. But the critical piece there, and it's using everything, your AI tools, all online learning, and we think you've become a near expert, which we define as knowing more than 99% about a topic, more than 90, sorry, more than 99% of the population, right? On some topic. But the kids choose their topic. So when you if you're trying to teach people how to really learn how to learn and how to become an expert in something, and you're doing that in a specific class that's organized from a knowledge standpoint, right? Then by definition, you've lost half the people anyway, because it's not their favorite thing.
No.
And so why wouldn't you just organize it the other way around and have them pick what they want to? And the reason is because the system isn't built that way.
Well,
And
set up to
so
teach
it's
the
just too difficult.
mean and motivate to the mean. Well, you're probably losing more than half. You have, a few that love it, a few that hate it, a few that could do without it, Yeah, I agree.
Well, and it's more than that. It's, yeah, the teaching to the mean is a challenge, right? But also, our educators are educated in a knowledge subject first, and that's their primary in most cases. Their primary. So if you look at a college, you're in a particular department. You've probably done a PhD in that subject, right? And that's the primary thrust of their credibility. And I want to see it changed. I want to see it the other way around, right? That their primary focus is on being an expert in an area that leads to success.
Well, I would think that they would first be an expert in instruction, right? And how to create that learning environment. I see a lot of people coming in who are experts in knowledge, but they can't convey that knowledge in a way that's engaging, in a way that where people walk away being able to perform differently. In fact, we don't, the metrics in college and again in K through 12 are not about performance usually, even though like we talk about instructional design and we should be having that piece of it as a formative assessment. But I, we're not a, I, you know, I, we're already not assessing the right things half the time, I believe. And I love your idea about picking something that, because it comes back to the motivation or what we would say reinforcing. If they pick something that they love to learn, like for me, you find your passion, you make it your niche, right? This is how you can become successful in an area. And when it's a reinforcer, when it's important to people, they'll give you discretionary effort. In other words, they're going to go above and beyond, even when you're not looking. So that kid that's not doing well in school, man, I mean, if you look in areas like, well, they're lazy. They're not lazy. They're not motivated by this topic. Believe me, they're home really engaged in their games. You know what I mean? They're not lazy when it comes to that stuff because it's very reinforcing to them, you know? And I think we can make learning very reinforcing. I think that to you know, if they're able to choose like a preference, like what is it that I want to learn? Then I think you're going to greatly, I'm surprised it's only half a point with the GPA. I would think it'd be more than that, you know? But there's other conditions that are motivating them. Like I don't want to get a bad grade, et cetera, et cetera. But I bet in the absence of those things as contingencies, I bet you would see a drastically bigger gap in terms of how people perform.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because, you know, the system we have for some kids, you could argue it helps improve their grit, right? So their grit's a very, very important attribute for success. You know, when things are down, it's hard, you can persevere, you don't quit with the first setback, right? And that's very important. But also, so is doing something you're passionate about. Yeah, because then it's effortless and it takes no effort to study. You know, when people are passionate about something, they read all kinds of extra things, you know, the time just disappears.
Think about right? it all the time.
Yeah. And whereas when you have to do something, you know, like, I mean, it's, you know, tax day, right? So, you know, like
Why'd
I
you have
had
to, say that, man?
To, yeah, but I'm sorry, but it is. And I had to get my information together to be able to, you know, fill in my taxes. And I hate it, the bureaucracy. There's no joy in it at all. You know, it's the number one reason why I wish we could just get rid of the whole system or something. I'll get in trouble for this, but just so that millions and millions and tens of millions of people wouldn't have to go through the pain of getting all the information together. And its only purpose is so that we don't get locked up for like getting our taxes wrong or fined. There's no joy in that. Imagine if we had all that time spent on something passionate that someone was passionate about. You know, it could be anything. I mean, it'd be wonderful. And the same is true all down through the school system. And I don't know what the right balance between having some painful thing where you have to go learn this in some boring way, but you have to tough it out to get at least a C, you know, at least pass the class, that helped develop grit. And the other side is, why don't you spend more of your time doing things that you're already passionate about? Because, you know, I was a terrible student at English and French. Okay, terrible. But I was really good at other subjects. Guess what? I don't do French or English anymore. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was never going to. And you know, the sooner we can funnel people into things, I don't mean have them have a narrow base of skills, remember? I'm talking about I want their skills and attributes to be very broadly developed, but through the subjects that they're passionate about, through the things they're interested in.
I mean, behavior analysis explains this very well. When behavior is driven by negative reinforcement, right? Negative reinforcement is fear of consequences. People are going to do just enough to get by and only when somebody's looking. It's why most of us do the speed limit because our behaviors are in contingencies of negative reinforcement, right? And we tend to only do the speed limit when the cop's present, right? As soon as they're in the rearview mirror, we're speeding by. But when you get people in touch with positive reinforcement, the things that they love, people always think positive reinforcement is about giving people pats on the back, et cetera, et cetera. No, man, when you're behaving in a way, it's producing some sort of naturally occurring reinforcers. I love the information I'm getting. I'm finding joy in this stuff. I have a love of learning. People are just going to keep going, man. And you know, this is not, we're not programming our schools. I don't think in K through 12 or college to create this love for this stuff. With the instructors, again, most of them do not even know how to instruct. You know, the metrics are about, the big metrics are people passing or failing. Right. That's assuming these assessments are really valid that they're doing. A lot of these they're developing themselves. It could be social validity, but social validity, unfortunately, is, you know, I don't even know that's a metric that professors are being judged by unless there's a constant issue in the classroom that might be leading to kids complaining a lot, dropping out. So that's an issue. I think this part, I'm glad that you bring this up about grit. That being very important that we deliberately build this into people. We have to build resiliency because there's no way to create a prosthetic world. There's going to be things that happen. And grit isn't anything magical. It's just people behaving well enough and long enough in pursuit of some goal, even under adverse conditions, right? Knowing that eventually they're going to produce this valued outcome. And I watch it build my fighters. A white belt comes in, they can resist an arm bar for 15 seconds, right? And then they tap out, right? Pretty soon that becomes 25 seconds, 45 seconds. Pretty soon they're getting out of it, right? And this is where the greatest fighters in the world know that no matter what, they're going to get through this stuff. And this is why resiliency is so important to develop. So I do believe that needs to be programmed into these environments. But let me ask you this. Do you think that social validity, right? How people feel about the way they're being taught, how people feel about, how they feel in the environment. Do you think this is a metric that should be attached to public education, colleges, right? Don't you think this is something that should be measured as opposed to the number of people graduating, the grades that are people don't, do you think that's an important metric?
Well, let me focus on what I do agree with you with. We're measuring the wrong things, okay, in a lot of cases, right? And even where we do measure the right ones, we're undermining them. So a great example is the SAT, right? Something that is highly valuable and is probably the most validated piece of data because it's nationally normed and so on, and there's such high numbers. And yet all of these colleges stopped using it as a measure of success for applicants coming in and potential, but they've all come back to it now. Okay, so even Harvard last week announced that they're using the SAT again. And so then when you come to something like social validity, I think it becomes very difficult. So I agree that there are problems, but I'm not necessarily sure exactly what we should be measuring in the current system. Okay, one of the impacts that you have in colleges is you sort of go, well, who's the consumer of us? The customer is the parents who are paying, right? But who's the consumer? Well, it's the student. So you go, well, what does the student think of the professor? And so they get a survey and they rank the professor or whoever's teaching the class, right? But the problem with that is that it drives grade inflation and it drives an easy class and it drives pandering. And so how does that lead to developing grit or excellence? I think it's a very difficult connection. So I think it just depends
Well,
on the
here's the thing with
details.
that, man. I think that socially there's bias in it. There's no doubt about it, right? But you'll get norms after a while, And I think that social validity shouldn't just be embedded in it. I mean, if you did industrial improvement, right? And so that's about performance training. You have a result, you have behavior. What do we want the frontline employee to be able to do? Okay. If we want them to be able to engage in that behavior to produce that result, what do we need the supervisor to do? And we're chaining that behavior up this performance chain. That's very important. And so a lot of people produce results, but not engaging in behavior that we would call ethical. There's different ways to get results, right? We can cheat, we can put the whip on people. And you look at the company or you look at the college saying, man, they're great. Look at the scores that are going on, right? But one of the things that we also do with social validity is saying, do you feel like this course was rigorous? Do you feel like you're learning from this stuff? Do you feel like the instructor was teaching you well enough? But that social validity should go up the chain, right? The professors be able to say, hey, how do I feel about how I'm being led and the resources I'm being given, or how invested are the students? I think it just is becomes a measure. Just one measure, but an important measure, because I've been in these schools, man, that are failing, and I've seen people turn them around. And the principal, for example, was beating up on the staff, metaphorically. But people look at it, and this is to your point, and they're like, well, that's the hero school. Look how well they've done. They've moved from a C to an A, But if you looked at it long term, you look at the data, you see that the retention rates were, falling, and it was not sustainable. And we got to make things that are that you know, they got we got to simplify things, but we got to have good metrics to look at that also find out how people are feeling about things. There is bias with it, no doubt. Again, but you compare that, and we use that as a piece of a measure in alignment with other data pieces of it. So, I mean, we could probably go back and forth on that, man. But I think checking in to see how people feel about things is important. I think it could inflate things, but it's not going to necessarily inflate things when you look at it across norms and you take into consideration, like, hey, this is how students normally feel. Like, where are you within that norm in that type of college? Like, why are they feeling so good about your classroom? Let's take a look. Maybe you are really not giving them rigor, right? So, I think it's just, you if you look at the data right, it can add, I think, an important variable, important metric.
Yeah, look, I think I agree with a lot of the points you're saying. I think as sort of an engineer at heart sort of thing, I think we need to be very careful on what the key metric is. And so, in fighting, it's did you win or lose the fight, right? It's a binary situation. Now there's context to that. So it could be
Leading
you won.
leading indicators. These are
Oh
kind
no,
of
there's leading
right.
indicators. Yeah, there's now, but I mean, even the win-loss, it's like if your first boxing match is against a young Mike Tyson, you're probably going to get beaten. Okay, so maybe strength of opponent as well then comes in. So
Sure.
there's ways you can make your measure more sophisticated, right? But win or loss is the key thing. Now, no doubt there are some leading indicators, like do people in the gym like the guy? Are they willing to spar with him or her? And like, does the coach feel motivated? Like, or they just, they have a bad attitude. There's all those things. But at the end of the day, the win-loss versus competition is sort of the critical thing. And so I think that perceptions and things are all well and good, and they can be helpful. They can also hide a lot of nonsense, like, oh, look, people, customers say they really like our new logo design for our company. It's like, yeah, are they buying more t-shirts from you? Like, that's like the goal is, if your t-shirt company, you got to sell t-shirts. It doesn't matter that you have 1,000 likes on Facebook if it doesn't translate into sales. And
I
so I think
agree.
that's the
I believe
key.
those metrics connect, right? So these are like on a roadmap. If you're driving down the road, these are the leading indicators. They're the mile markers going by. Let us know we're moving the right direction. Ultimately, it's that result, but even that result, right? Let's say that giving you that example of hey, you fought the actual fight and you won the fight. All right, you won, but how did you win? Did you win engaging in the behaviors that you were trained in to do it? Or did you win doing something else, right? Because if you won doing something else, that's not a metric of the success of that program. This person adapted to overcome this stuff, maybe, unless you've taught them to adapt, and that's a metric, right? But if you've trained them in some specific skills and they did not use that, right? Maybe they turn out to be very powerful and, gifted somehow, and they're doing some stuff. That's not a measure of the program. It's not just about winning. It's just how you won. What behaviors did you actually engage in? The measure of leadership, the measure of these programs are actually it found in the behavior of the followers, the behavior of the learners, right? So I think it's the performance that they're doing. And if you've pinpointed and taught the right performance, the right behaviors, then you will achieve the right results, if that makes sense.
Yeah, look, I agree, and education measurement is always, it's very, very controversial, right? It's a lovely idea, but doing it in practice is difficult. And the same in medicine. So, if you're a doctor and they're going to measure you on, I don't know, the failure rate of some surgery you perform. Well, what you're going to do is you're not going to take the difficult patients, because I mean, you get patients in, sometimes, and they get 50-50 where they survive. You're like, oh, well, let's give it to the other doctor because I want my measure to look good. So there's always like good intent and like some good science behind these efforts, but sometimes the practical thing is difficult. And I think one of the challenges that I've seen as somebody who's lived and studied on three continents, right, or and with my kids and stuff, is one of the particular failings in the American system, I think, is an over-reliance at high school on GPA and a class grade assigned by the teacher who is teaching you. I actually think it's basically worthless. And certainly, when we were recruiting kids for our consulting company, we needed super talent. We didn't pay any attention to it at all. It's a worthless metric. And I just wish we could get rid of that, because I don't think it's helpful for the dynamic. And you go, yeah, but you've got to measure something. I go, yeah. Let's measure the key attributes. Let's measure knowledge attainment. But it's got to be more along the lines of these tests that people don't like, right? Like your SAT and other things and subject matter tests. But there's got to be some sort of national standards independent of the school
I would
and
like to.
independent of the teacher.
I agree with that, man. I don't believe in the GPA and those assessments, that are developed there, because there's a lot of issues that come with it. I would like to see simulations again, coming back to let's put you under conditions where you actually have to perform the knowledge and skills that, and again, they can be this, to make it scalable, they can be generated with computers, right? And where people can learn, and there's constant formative assessments going on and letting people know. I think this is the right way. I mean, I can, how many times have you had seen a CV or a resume come by your desk, and then you hired people. I think to your point, you're like, well, this looks nothing like what, it's saying on here. And I think the world is actually moving in this direction. Like IT, nobody cares about your degree anymore. It's about what can you actually do. I've never cared about the people's degree, man. I'm gonna want with leadership. This is where I specialize. I care about how you're treating the people, and not about your power. How you're treating the people with the least amount of power in the room, right? I want to find out how you're arranging the environment in a way that optimizes performance, in a way where people feel good about it, feel safe. I want to retention metrics. That's important to me, et cetera, et cetera. And are you doing that? Is that how you're getting results? If you're producing results other ways, like through coercion, I don't really care for you very much, right? I think over time you're creating mental health issues, you're creating medical issues, you're probably losing money. Although I think under high stakes conditions, this is in public education, this is in like non-for-profit, right? People will step over their mother's back to make a buck. When you get into like maybe the stock market and stuff like that, they'll all powerful money as a reinforcer. Makes people throw out their values and just move towards, how much money it's going to produce. But in education, You don't have that, man. We're pumping out in the United States, brother. I mean, like, if we're going to reduce poverty, reduce incarceration, improve mental health, improve quality of life, we have to improve we have to improve education, because, you know, again, to your point, 100 years, not much has changed, man, you know? So it sounds like I'm not going to get the skills in it, right? I know this is kind of like what you're doing there, you know? Like, I'd love to get a, you know, maybe one of them. That would be awesome.
Okay, let's come to that. But the thing, one thing I just want to jump in with is, I'm so optimistic about the future and the use of technology, because exactly what you're talking about now, lots of businesses are moving to skills-based hiring. Okay. Yes. And so, and you can measure now how people are doing. So therefore you can truly, truly allow anyone who's motivated to rise. Okay. Now there's some limitations, right? If your gross mental ability is in the bottom quartile, it's unlikely you'll run Goldman Sachs one day. But putting that aside, it doesn't matter where you come from, because you can go learn anything you want online. You can go to night school. You can talk with friends. You can have a study group. You can read. That. You can do anything you want. Yeah. And you'll be able to be tested on your skill live. Mm-hmm. Some AI is going to come on. It's, you know, have some avatar, and it's going to ask you questions and create a scenario. You're going to have to demonstrate that competence. And so there will be no barrier from people being able to.
I love that. It becomes a skill. We're breaking down this composite thing, the skills. You can learn the skills. It might take me 3 weeks to learn something. It takes you a week. But if I really want it, I stick the course very clear in the sequence. Love that. Exactly. Wonderful.
As opposed to this idea at the moment, you graduated from high school, you didn't. You know, you went to Yale, or you didn't, or you did whatever.
Now that you have the skill, or you don't.
Correct. And like, so if I'm hiring someone and they happen to be a 52-year-old from, you know, who just came across the border from Guatemala and, you know, blah, 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 and we test them and their skills work. You know, and they're good, great, hire them. You know, or they might be an 18-year-old who doesn't want to go to college, who tests and they have the skills. I could hire both of them and they can go and do whatever that job is. I don't really care. And we'll have the ability to overcome those biases and preconception. And more importantly, people will be able to have a direct link to their personal effort and the result that they're doing. Whereas at the moment it's so nebulous.
Yeah, like, but, you know, brother, I have a book. One of my books is called MMA Science. What do they call it? A training, coaching, and belt ranking guide. And so in martial arts, when you move up a belt, it's very subjective, right? So the coach might, the trainer, the, you know, the sensei might test you and determine how well you do this stuff. But what we did was identify the key skills people need to engage in. And we rank them by order: white belt, yellow belt, orange belt, right? And then we operationalize those skills, right? We broke them down in the components. So it's very clear. So the learner can learn outside of it, right? They can study the skills. There's videos that go along with them, right? So it becomes a skill. So it becomes very measurable. It becomes very objective. Either you've engaged in these skills, right, correctly, or you didn't, because they're all laid out. And so it provides this very clear path for people who are very motivated and they want to, you know, like, hey, I know independently I can self-monitor that I can engage in these skills. Now I'm ready to test, right? And so I think it aligns with what you're saying. It's a direct line to be able to perform, because in the end, you've got to be able to perform the skills or not. At least you can see that, you know, at least it puts it into the hands of the learners to do that.
Yeah, look, that kind of structure and understanding and breaking it down, I think it's very, very important. And, you know, I wonder when we'll have all of that available online without needing the sensei.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Well, that's what we did. We actually did something where it's a self-paced thing where you actually exactly have that, right? We said, come learn on your own. Here's the video. Here's the task analysis, right? Yeah. The sensei really, like, when you're ready, go in and the sensei gives you the belt, right? The belt rankings are important to people. You know, they want to feel like they've moved up in the world. I think that's one thing that you get. A lot of people go to college because they want the degrees. It makes you feel good. It separates you. It gives you status. You know, it shows that you work for things. So I think that that stuff is still important to people. You know, they want to feel separated, especially in the United States. I think in, you know, you've studied abroad. Maybe it's different in Japan. I'm not sure if they have a more individualized culture, or is it more like a collective group, you know, consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the US is probably the most individualistic culture in the whole world. So everywhere else is going to be different than that. Like, you know, we're the most freedom loving, do your own thing. It's great. And of course, I live in New Hampshire, so you know, even our state motto, even our state motto is wonderful for that. But yeah, no, that's exceptional. But yeah, I mean, there's so much to this. And like, the future is so bright with the potential of what we can do. And here's the thing, you mentioned about a degree, but here's a challenging thought for you. Have you ever seen a study that demonstrates that getting a degree adds any, let's just limit it to financial benefit to your life?
that's limited. I've seen degrees provide you higher degrees associated with more income. So yes, I've seen a number of
Well,
those studies.
no, but let me just check. So there are studies that show people who have a degree and people who don't have a degree and what's their average income. And
Yes.
those show that people with a degree,
Right.
but that isn't causative, that's correlative. So that's saying that the brighter people who were better financed and more personally motivated at that age, they go on and they do better. Well, that's not surprising, right? But if you take people with the same abilities at 18 and you track them and you see where they go, going to college and getting a four-year degree, there's very, very little evidence that adds any value at all to their long-term prospects. And yet this is, well, it's like very poorly understood. And it's these massive things that I just find so shocking. Like you would think it would be the best studied, best proven thing in the world. Because other than buying a house, it's the most expensive thing that anyone will ever do. And yet, if we're buying a house, we compare mortgages. We like have all these standards and regulations on the quality of the build. There's loads of legal stuff. We have experts help us. And when we go to college, we just take on a whole load of debt. And there isn't actually any real proof that it's going to add any value to you, an individual. And it's shocking.
I think that I would think that, and I would like to see that research. Maybe you can send me the link on it. I think that, and I'm watching it, my son right now in the IT world, and I like the way the directions that are gonna that things are going. I've seen so many people with doctor degrees, with higher degrees. I'm like, I did not care if I'm like, what did you get at college, man? You know what I mean? Like, they just, they use the degree almost to put themselves in a position of authority over others. And that kind of thing drives me nuts. They didn't necessarily have the knowledge skills. I've unpacked like leadership prep courses. I'm like, this is missing all the science, right? The DNA of leadership is not in here. So they're really learning on the job through trial and error, which means what was the point of their degree? Well, the degree for a lot of people gives them, again, it gives them position because people are being hired based on their degree. To your point, though, that doesn't mean they are able to perform the skills, which I love the idea of performance-based hiring. Like there's real assessments that allow people to demonstrate the skills. But in the absence of that, I think degrees still is opening the doors for people to get higher jobs. It definitely the doors close if you don't have certain degrees, right? Without that. So I think that as things stand right now, I don't think a degree is a measure of your ability to perform, right? Just like we have you're a black belt, right? That's a degree. We put you in the fight, you take a beating, you couldn't do the job. You know what I mean? You might have a belt, you got the ranking from somebody, but that doesn't necessarily you have the knowledge and skills to be successful. You got to be able to actually do the stuff in the real fight. And so I think that will solve the problem. But until that happens, the degree is definitely opening the doors for people, but I think that needs to happen because it's not about your degree. It's about can you do the job? Can you perform successfully? And I love that. I hope we continue to move in that direction.
Well, let me just be clear on this point. I'm not saying that having a degree is unhelpful at the moment because there are barriers to people applying to certain jobs based on whether they have a degree or not. What I'm saying is there's no evidence that having the degree leads to higher performance in your life in either financial income or personal happiness. And employers are increasingly dropping the degree requirement. So that's a massive trend that is happening throughout the US in governments, local governments, and also in businesses. And the list of businesses, I think we have a link on our website to a whole bunch of businesses that don't require a degree for a lot of positions now. And so what I'm saying is if you go forward 5 years or 10 years, at the moment, like if I was to say to one of my kids, don't bother about college, then that might cause an issue in certain circumstances, but it won't cause an issue on the long-term performance. It might make it harder to get their first job in certain areas. But by and large, that's not true. And I think it'll be radically different in 5, 10 years, especially with skills-based hiring and the ability to assess people accurately on their demonstrated skills when you interview.
Well, and I think when we have that, then I think those should inform colleges, right? These are the skills that people are looking for. And then the colleges are programmed to ensure that people have those skills. And they have these simulations embedded in there to make sure that when they go out into the real world, that they're going to get hired based on this stuff. So we really start to accelerate the competition there. We're going to have some a really skilled workforce coming in if that's what we're doing. Like, I think vocational schools have gotten it right, compared to what we're doing because they have to do hands-on stuff. Nobody, and of course, the medical field in many instances has it right. Like you don't want to be operated on if people don't know how to operate, if they haven't actually done surgery, and gotten feedback on it, you don't want a guy working on your AC if they haven't repaired ACs. They come out, with good internships. Like the way things are set up right now, the knowledge is not generalizing. So I love the idea of having a very specific subset of skills that people need to be hired, and then those should be informing, because right now, what are the standards in colleges? What are the standards that are being K through 12, and how are they aligned with real life? And how are we generalizing those everywhere? If you can pick a career and become, I think it comes back to your point earlier, and I believe this as well, like, what do you love to do? Like, make that thing your niche. You know what I mean? Here's the clear pathway to doing that stuff. And of course, before that stuff, fundamentally, and you said this offline at the beginning, let's make sure at the beginning of your educational career, right, that we teach people to better assess, problem solve, make decisions, and take action. Let's we teach them to adapt. We teach them a love of learning, and then things are going to explode. Because right now, brother, I think you'd agree with me, things are really moving. I mean, education is a major crisis, which means that things like you're bringing to the world, Nat, I think there's opportunity for this, man, because I think it was just going to continue to go in a slow death, a slow grind in the wrong direction until things are in crisis. And right now they are. Teacher shortages, we're changing the assessment criteria. I mean, they're going to put the SAT back in place, and you know what's going to happen, brother? They're going to adjust that. They'll probably adjust it again. Why? Because their enrollment's going to go down, or they're going to have to create a whole nother program that leads to people being able to get into college, because people aren't going to be able to pass the SATs because they're not getting what they need in college or in K through 12 too often.
Well, maybe they should just skip college. And so, of course, that's what we're ultimately up to at Futures Forge is there's this gap in what's being taught, right? We believe people are not being developed in the way they need to be at college and at high school. And so we're filling that gap with our program to focus on these exact things. And in the long run, the goal is that people can skip college who want to skip college, because it's expensive and it's kind of childish, a lot of college these days. I don't know if you've been on campus recently. It certainly doesn't seem to be like it was in my day. Everyone's just wandering around on their phones with their headsets plugged in. It's not the same dynamic. And so that's the goal. The goal is to actually make sure people get a chance to learn and develop the skills that they really need to succeed, rather than sort of parking themselves in an old, I think, broken and outdated system.
I'm all about this, brother. Give me one example of skill, man. I love what you're talking about. Just one
So,
example of a skill, yeah.
one of them, we've already talked about it, but critical thinking, right? So critical thinking obviously is critical, because you have to learn to make decisions and from a situation, analyze it, understand, to see what action you can take that's going to help. And here's the scary thing, because every teacher will almost say, or educator that I know will say, oh yeah, and we help improve critical thinking. And it's like, well, okay, let's go look at the science. Okay, so I'm not the researcher. My business partner went to MIT and loves research. And so he did a lot of searching to try and find out, well, where's there evidence that people's critical thinking improves at college? Because you'd think, wow, that's really important. There must have been a lot of studies. People must want to know how to do that the best, right? How do you develop it the best way? And surely you go norm across, thousands of people. So he was only able to find one study that, of scale, proper study. It had 2,000 freshmen who were measured coming in, and then they were assessed 2 years later, okay, when they came back for the start of their third year. And the horrible thing is, half of them didn't improve their critical thinking at all into their first 2 years of college. And if you went and got a job at McDonald's, like, you'd probably improve your critical thinking. Like, there's things happening, you got to work stuff out, right? So,
It just has to happen.
And so just get into the workplace and do stuff. There's problems all day. There's situations all day you can learn from. And so the idea that, now, look, the other half, there was improvement and there was improvement on average, but it's like, is it enough to justify 2 years of your life and however many
Well, you
tens
don't
of
know if they're
thousands of
learning through
dollars?
college as well. It could be their other experiences that they're having. How do
Well,
we isolate that
absolutely.
variable?
Oh, absolutely. We're just saying at all, because, obviously colleges aren't directly teaching most of the stuff people need to learn. Where they are learning it at all, it's ancillary. It's like, I don't know, you're part of some club, or you join a sports team and you've got to organize things. You're probably learning the critical skills that way, not through your actual classes, which is why I say the tuition bill's worth almost nothing. The room and board, no problem with people paying for room and board at college. Sure, being in community there's probably the only bit that's adding significant measurable value. So
Well, all right, man. This has been, listen, I'm on board with this. I really love the idea of giving people the skills to be successful. It's all going to come back to their behaviors, right? Providing them a path to do it any way that, if they can save a lot of money, that's wonderful. I don't know that I think what's going to happen is that colleges are going to have to adapt, right? If they don't adapt, they're not going to survive. And it sounds like you're putting out a model that, they could, I don't know, that could be their blueprint for doing it. What, before we come to end, I want to know, like, would you have career paths? You know what I mean? Like, so they're learning skills, are there career paths people can choose to learn these skills? Like, what does it look like?
Yeah, I think that the reality of the modern world is the sort of idea of a career path's kind of dead. We're going to have to reskill every 5 years and learn new things, which means we can pivot into other areas or industries and that sort of thing. And so, yes, there are going to be people who stay in healthcare or in education. They're such big spaces, but people are going to have to relearn. And so, it's how do you reduce the cost to you and society to learn the new things you need to learn. And to me, that's what it's all about. So the path is, ultimately the vision I have is that instead of after high school, we have people invest 4 years and a huge ton of treasure, right? And then in theory, they're on their way for 40 years. I'd like to see them spend like a year, 6 months, go work for 3 years, then come back and do 6 more months learning something, that they need to. And of course, they're going to learn every day along the way. But this idea of instead of it being like 4 and 40, that it's kind of like more continuous and broken up. So to
I
it
think
comes
it's
closer
great.
to the need.
Yeah.
That's sort
Distributed
of the
learning's better
vision.
anyhow.
That's the sort of vision we have. And then in terms of careers, it's like, look, the skills and attributes we're focused on are universal. They're ubiquitously needed across any industry. It doesn't really matter what you're going to.
Okay. Oh yeah. I like the idea of well, I could see this being I could see having paths would still be effective. You want to be in education, you don't want to learn all those other things. So, but it sounds like you're getting down to some what we might call pivotal behaviors or behavioral cusps. Learn these things and you'll be able to learn across any
Correct.
industry, right? So it's more like
Correct.
metacognitions or something.
Well, and just to jump in there, it's because it's going to be, if we teach people how to become a near expert in 4 weeks in something and they have built all of the other platform,
Then they can
okay,
go
then
to others.
it's pretty easy to make that jump, you see. And it's sort of like in athletics, if I take the fittest, best athlete you can find, like LeBron James 20 years ago, I could probably stick him in almost any other sport as well and have him perform. Well, no, but I mean, okay, maybe not ballet. Okay. You put him in a
He's
rowing
gonna take an
boat.
ass whooping in boxing MMA, brother.
Well,
I'll be honest, man.
you
But
teach
he's
him to
gonna
play
learn
rugby,
quicker. He's gonna
Yes.
learn what, he's I think he's gonna accelerate his learning under those conditions
Correct.
because it comes with a core subset of pivotal behaviors, behavioral cusp, right?
Correct.
So I
I
agree
bet
with
he would have been a mean netball player, I bet as well.
that. I don't even know what netball is, brother. Anyways, man. Well, listen, this has really captured my interest a lot. I'm really intrigued by this whole concept. I wish you well, man. I hope you come back on maybe next year to let me know how things are going. I want you to make sure that you email me anything you want in the show notes so people can have access. But just while they're listening, if they want to get in contact with you or you want them to head over to your website, what are the best locations for them?
So the best thing to do is to go to futuresforge.org, and that's the best place to find me, and no doubt we'll have it linked to this. And go learn about what we're doing and help us or criticize us so we can get better. All feedback is a gift, after all.
That's what I'm talking about. All right, Nat. Thanks a lot, brother.
Thank you, Paul.
Traditionally, many crisis management systems have taken a what's wrong with you approach that begins as a person escalates when addressing behavioral issues. PCM, as a trauma-informed approach rooted in applied behavior analysis, shifts this perspective from what's wrong with you to what happened to you by having a complete picture of a person's situation in life, past and present. This approach is fundamental to applied behavior analysis and therefore PCM as it seeks to determine the root causes of behavior based on both the current environment and the individual's history as a means of individualizing education, treatment, and support. For more about PCM, check out crisisintervention.com.